Okay, today is July 11th, 2019. Excuse me, this is an interview with Mike Kinderman. We are here at a conference room in Turner House. My name is Troy Reeves. I'm with the UW-Madison Archives. So, Mike, to help me with sound quality, can you say your name and spell your last name?
Yeah, my name is Mike Kinderman, K-I-N-D-E-R-M-A-N.
Okay. So, Mike, I'm just going to turn this sideways just to get the microphones pointing more towards us. I'm just going to check that to make sure it looks good. Okay. Mike, this is sort of a – well, we're going to start with the first half of this initial question that I gave you, and that's what brought you to UW-Madison?
What I would say is that this might be surprising. It was really construction, frankly. Mm-hmm. I never dreamed that I'd be getting into what I've gotten into here. Mm-hmm. UW Housing was starting its first master plan and really its first major kind of construction project with the state. Mm-hmm. And they decided to hire construction reps, two of them actually, and I was one of those they decided to hire.
Okay. Did you just say construction rep?
Construction representatives.
Okay.
It's a classification, an older classification that
okay.
was to hire it.
Okay. So what were you doing for a vocation before you were hired here as a construction rep?
Yeah, so prior to that, I, of course, worked construction for a number of years and was a carpenter, actually. Mm-hmm. Ended up working just prior to coming here. I was working for a utility. It happened to be Northern States Power. Eventually became Xcel Energy, which is all over kind of Minnesota, mm-hmm. North Dakota, mm-hmm. and so forth. I interned with them in college. And eventually went on full-time with them. So I was working for Northern States Power prior to coming here. It wasn't necessarily in the construction area. So I was really looking to get more back into that area, an area that I was probably a little more familiar with than kind of the drawing control. Because up there, I started my internship. I actually, all the utility lines and gas lines are all mapped out. Mm-hmm. So my job was to make sure those maps were accurate. That mm-hmm. was really, so I'd literally drive for days mapping out utility lines, mm-hmm. Come back, make sure they're accurate, make sure the phasing's correct, and all kinds of different things. So mm-hmm. that's kind of what I did mm-hmm. for them.
Right. So how did you become interested in construction?
So in high school, and this is goofy, so my girlfriend's dad owned a construction company. That's how it started. I ended up working for him as a gopher when I was fairly young and, kind of progressed. And I went to tech school for air conditioning and refrigeration, eventually graduated there. I all the time I was working construction for him. He was very good about working around whatever hours I had. And then I eventually took a job actually down in Madison. This is kind of where I liked the Madison area. So I took a job in the refrigeration area in Madison for a year. But then he called me back up. This is prior to me starting college. And he was looking for someone. And he said he would work around whatever hour. He knew I wanted to go back to college. Mm. And he would work around whatever college hours I needed if I would be willing to come back and work as a carpenter for him. Mm. So it kind of worked out. I was able to go to school and pay for school. Came out with very little debt at the time.
Right.
But worked some long hours. I mean, I worked 30, 40 hours a week while going to college.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was pretty intense mm-hmm. at the time.
So after you got those degrees, and then you said you were working for Northern States. So eventually you moved away from construction in Wisconsin to the Northern States.
Northern States Power, yeah. So I stopped the construction. I took on an internship there the last year or so. while I was in college, happened to be right at Stout, right in Menominee, in their field office. And then when I graduated, I ended up being moved over to Eau Claire for Northern States Power. But at the same time, I was always recruiting. So I only work full-time with Northern States Power for probably less than a year or so. At that time, I was looking for jobs. I was looking for jobs more so in the construction area. And this one opened up and came down and applied. There were some interesting things I thought about this job. How it was sold to me was interesting, and I still use this with all of our staff. So when I, and I'll never forget it, you know, University Housing is a program revenue entity. We don't require anyone to stay with us. We don't require anyone to live with us, which means we need to operate like a business, and we need to do a great job for our customers, or we won't be successful. That was very interesting to me compared to what I had heard. You know, you hear things about state workers and this that and the other thing. That was a different, that was different when I interviewed. And that was interesting to me. And I still remember that, strangely enough, so many years ago.
So as you first got here and got settled, were there people who maybe not officially mentored you, but sort of helped you with your job and also with sort of learning about what UW-Madison is?
Gosh, I had a number of people. Paul Evans, a previous director. I don't know if he's a person you've ever spoken with.
No, but we certainly should.
He's retired. You know, Paul was my, maybe not my direct boss originally, but my direct boss for a number of years. Mark Rossler is probably that other person who has really kind of managed an area. He's, and both of these individuals, I still, you know, Mark Rossler, I still, lives by me, him and his wife, we go out for dinner. But they were certainly instrumental. Those were the two that actually interviewed me too, you know, interesting enough. But they had the insight into the political piece. You know, the construction projects in our state can be very political at times. They also had the relationship with state entities because our construction projects are a bit micromanaged, I would say, by the state. And a lot of what we get done is really through relationships, to be honest. And they were very good at building those relationships with the right people and helped me get a foot in.
So what was the first construction project? You said that this was a time they were doing not only first master plan, but there was construction projects going on.
The first one was actually Holt Commons right over here. We renovated the lower level and the upper kind of dining area. Strangely enough, since then, we've re-renovated it. And the dining unit isn't even there anymore. That's now DeJope, Four Lakes Market. But that was the first.
So you have, looks like you were there here as a construction rep and a project coordinator for about 2.5 years. And then moved on to being a facility manager.
At that time, the facilities area was split up into, originally it was three areas. It was two when I took that position. And what I mean by that, we had a Southeast and Lakeshore area. There were two functional residence hall facilities groups, all with the same structure, and really kind of ran a lot of times independent of one another, strangely enough. So they had a kind of an area manager. construction component, a housekeeping component, a mechanical maintenance component. They all reported through a director, but those managers kind of ran their own areas.
Mm-hmm. So you had mentioned that when you were, sort of go back, when you were hired, there were two construction reps. Is that because
correct.
There was construction rep for each?
There were two areas. Okay. I started in Lakeshore. That's
okay.
correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you started in Lakeshore but moved to Southeast. Was there, I mean, since they were two separate entities, was there a difference? Did you sense a difference, or did you have experience of a difference between the two?
So, so at that time, the reason I wound up in Southeast, and it, you know, the interesting piece too, I came here for construction and then ended up at that age really managing a whole bunch of people, mm-hmm. which wasn't expected. I went to Southeast because of there were some issues in the area at the time, and that area manager actually was demoted at the time. And Paul had come to me and asked me if I would take that position. And so I simply moved down there. I did not know those facilities very well. Mm-hmm. I was really only working in Lakeshore at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of how I wound up
okay.
in that area.
So,
if I remember correctly, I really applied for the Lakeshore position. There might have been a position in Lakeshore at the time.
Okay. So, what happens a lot of times, and so I'm in the humanities, what happens a lot of times in the humanities is you become, people find out that you're good at something, and then they try to see if you're good at something else. And that something else usually ends up being, you know, managing people.
Mm-hmm.
So you move from being a construction rep to actually managing people. How did you learn how to do that?
Well, I, up front, I'm not so sure I was great at it, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm.
In the construction area, we had to work a lot through relationships. So I probably was okay at building relationships and listening and understanding, which was probably the cornerstone, I think, of being a good manager or supervisor.
Mm-hmm.
I am sure, although that was a long time ago, I had my bumps and bruises and so forth. I tend to think I do try and learn from every experience, even tough ones,
mm-hmm.
And so forth. That's probably helped me. And, you know, over time, I've developed as a person, I think, you know, seeing what... starting off making mistakes and learning from those mistakes. And that's kind of what made me better. I do think that that's one thing I think I do fairly well is that I'm always listening, I'm always seeking to understand,
mm-hmm.
looking for feedback,
mm-hmm.
And trying to get people comfortable to give me feedback, which is a whole challenge in
mm-hmm.
itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and... convert that into improvement, really. So those things, I think, have helped me succeed in mm-hmm. a number of different ways over the years. Not that I still don't make mistakes. So.
Mm-hmm. I think we probably all.
Yeah.
So I know it was a long time ago. I know sometimes as you start to reflect upon your life, it's tough to sort of compartmentalize things, but it looks like you were there for Southeast Residence Hall Facility Manager for about 3 years.
Right.
Are there either specific projects or events that stand out in your mind while you were doing that job?
Yeah, there were, I mean, I look at that period as a huge learning experience for me. I mean, I was, I'm trying to think of how old I would have been. Probably just... upper 20s or maybe 30-some. I don't know. But all the people at that time, we had a lot of long-term people that I've had here, you know. Mm-hmm. So I actually went down there. I would have been, like I said, up 20s, 30s. But most of the people probably working in the area would have been upper 40s, 50s, and I'd been there. So it was a, I think, an immense learning experience for me. And that's where I know I had some bumps and bruises. I think there's a lot of different experiences that I can think of. Some of them not pleasant. Some of them, some of them maybe a little pleasant. Gosh, I'm not answering this very well.
Well, if you want, I mean, it's up to you whether you want to give a what I call sort of a for example, yeah, about that time, whether it's, you know, one that left you a little more scarred or one that didn't.
Well, I think it's a time where I figured out what I wanted to be, or mm-hmm, what people working, what I wanted our team to be. I can't say I was seeing that at that time. But that's, I think, when I figured that out, how I wanted the team to work together. I wasn't there, nor was I making it happen at the time. Mm. But I knew what I didn't want and what I wanted to mm-hmm see. I think I figured that out mm-hmm in those years.
So, do you have, like, I always think a lot of life is figuring out what you don't want to do. So, do you have an example of an experience? And again, you know, you don't need to necessarily name names if it involves other people, but figuring out, okay, this is what I don't want in the future to have happen.
It's so strange I remember this. This is a very extreme event, okay, but I remember a fire alarm going off in one building. I needed a mechanic to go over and address that. It happened to be lunchtime. I knew where he was taking lunch with other individuals. I went to find him. And I asked him if he would go over and address. And I got the reply that, well, I'll do it after my lunch. So that's kind of, does that mm-hmm like a negative? That's a good example of right what I don't want to see in people.
Right. Okay.
And I, you know, and immediately after you address the situation and you figure that out in a very professional way, you start thinking about, well, what do I do then to get people thinking a little bit differently right about that? What are the steps you start taking? And that's where I think that time for me was where I started figuring that out. Mm-hmm. Those kinds of things would happen. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yep. So then from that position, you actually move into the position that you currently hold.
Yeah. Cool.
Was that a position you had to apply for?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And actually, I wasn't even the final candidate. I was actually sick, because I'll still remember Paul coming to my office and telling me he had hired, matter of fact, it was a person from Missouri. I still remember that. And I hired a person, and that was tough. And but after, strangely enough, it was a week or a week and a half later, Paul shows up in my office again and says the person dropped out and I'd like you to be the director. Hmm. So that was kind of interesting. And now that I think about it, you know, the position, the area manager position, he did hire, I was second there actually as well. He hired someone new into Lakeshore. And then that situation happened in Southeast. Oh. And the position opened up, and he was able to use the same recruitment, and he asked me to take that
okay
position.
Hmm.
That's so two times in a row, I guess it's better to be lucky than good sometimes. But I ended up taking that position and kind of going from there.
Right. So this, to get it on the record, although it's here in your CV, that'll be in the file, Director of Residence Hall Facilities.
That's correct.
Okay. So you've been doing this job now for over 20 years. Congratulations. So one of my questions that I gave you was, you know, how do you describe when people find out that you're the Director of Residence Hall Facilities and ask, what is that? How do you describe that to people?
Well, let me, here's what I, so I meet with all new staff, every new staff person that comes to work for us in facilities. I, and actually Carolyn Bell, our associate director, we sit down with, and we simply say that our job is to support our team. We do whatever we need to make our team successful and you successful. Our frontline staff, I will tell you that they have way more contact with our customer than I do. They're the ones that make us successful. So our job is to support them, particularly when that customer, you know, when we market by word of mouth. We need to do a good job. That means we don't require anyone to stay with us. So if our frontline staff was out there every day seeing our customer daily isn't doing a good job, that's where we start sliding. So they're us supporting them with tools, resources that they need to do a good job is really what my day's about. That's how I look at it. Right?
So to follow up with that, and you addressed that a little bit here, understanding there's probably no such thing as a typical day.
Correct.
But what are some of the things that, that could happen in a day that's more typical than others?
There's always questions about projects. I typically am not the person day to day on our projects. You know, right now, like a project like Witte that we have going on, we have Adam Rattel. He's kind of our point person down there, but I'll talk to him about all, you know, typically he's checking in with me and asking me questions. What do you think about this? Or I'm asking him questions. So there's always project questions. There's typically people and process questions. You know, we have, geez, we have 80 some full-time staff and hundreds of student staff. So there's always concerns or issues or questions that come up throughout the day. I tend to, myself and Carolyn, we're typically involved with anything that might be considered complicated and, and so forth. We do, you know, people stop in too. I mean, like last Friday, I mean, I took a call from one of our custodians in Chadburn. She wanted to talk to me about something. And I figure out the time to get over there. You need to listen to staff. I mean, we're always looking for feedback and trying to engage really our team, which is not always easy. And, you know, in the now with we have 40 or 50 with English as a second language. So the communication piece is something we spend a bit of time on too. Something as simple as getting something out. Matter of fact, I was just reading some feedback on the total title and comp piece. We really try and get this information about those info sessions and out to staff, and we fell short. And you know, so try and figure out ways to get better, you know. That'll be some, those kind of things come up. I mean, we didn't do a great job as a team probably getting word out to, but in particular those who have English as a second language for a number of different reasons. That so daily, we're looking to make things better. Other things. gosh, there's always questions about mechanicals and people questions.
So do you think, this may be a dumb question, but do you think your background, even though you're not really doing construction, do you think having a background in construction has allowed you to be successful at this position?
It certainly has. We do, so the mechanical piece, you know, that my air conditioning degree, that, I mean, we have in refrigeration, so I have, it's, my background's kind of, I have this construction piece, and then I spent a bit of time in the, you know, for 2 years really in that associate degree, and then working a year in the refrigeration field helped too as well. So really both the mechanical and the construction piece. I think it's certainly helped from working through mechanical issues that we have. From that side, I will tell you, as far as construction, you know, building relationships, I think on this campus is huge. You never do anything alone. And I've done pretty well at that. And it's helped me in this role, because you just can't go about running an operation like this, smaller, bigger, alone. You know, you need support from other areas, whether it be HR, whether it be FP&M, whether it be DFD, DOA, whoever it might be.
So I want to ask a couple of questions about a couple of the bullet points that you have here. I want to sort of follow up on the typical day thing, because one of your bullet points say that, you know, you orchestrate the 3-day residence hall move in, move out. So in a sense, it's typical because it happens, you know, every year.
Cyclical, yeah.
Yeah. But I'm guessing it's not super typical in a sense that it's always a little different.
It is. Every year it's different.
But could you, because we don't know who will be listening to this, try to at least to provide a bit of an overview of the process?
Yeah. So, so our move-in, here's how I kind of think about it. We have about 7,600 or so residents, most of which probably have never been to a town our size, but unless they came for SOAR, or they clearly don't know their way around. 7,600 is bigger, kind of bigger than most cities in Wisconsin, actually, if you start adding them up. And we bring that many people in, not knowing really their way around or process on how to go about it, in a few days. So it really takes, you know, and you said it, every year's different. And a lot of it's different because of construction or road construction or building construction and so forth. But we have to work with, and it's really a relationship thing. I mean, the number of people that we work with to make this happen are, we've had to work with DOT when the Beltline, we have Beltline concerns. Clearly the city of Madison, which would include the Madison PD, Madison Fire Department, the Madison City Transit, and the Parks Division, who typically approves street permits and so forth. And then on campus, I mean, clearly UWPD, we work closely with transportation services, and then just making sure everyone else is aware, because we clearly have an impact on the functioning campus as a whole when we start shutting things down. So we try and get as much information out as we can to those who are going to impact. Maybe we're not working with them, but clearly we're impacting them. So the planning for something like that, you know, we start in January, really, January, February, prior to that move-in, really starting to work through all the details, depending on what the circumstances are for the year. I remember one year we actually had, I don't know if you remember when Johnson Street was under construction. We actually worked it out with the city. We were able to use Johnson Street for parking, for move-in. I don't know if you remember that. Mm-hmm. But that's kind of an interesting thing that, you know, so we try and take advantage of things that are going on, right, to make it better for ourselves. And a few years back, we, you know, worked with the city to eventually, I struggled for a long time trying to get our ability. I've asked, years ago, I tried to get Dayton Street closed down for a long period of time, and there was always a lobby against that, particularly from, are you a big biker? Mm-hmm. Do you bike a lot?
No.
But the bike lobby in Madison has they're pretty strong. And the Dayton Street is a big bike thoroughfare. There was a lot of pushback, believe it or not, to close down Dayton from that group to help with move-in and so forth. Eventually, ended up working, and this is where years in advance, working with traffic engineering about, and they knew there were concerns about the ped traffic and the car traffic, and then trying to get people moved in when people, you know, when you don't close down Dayton, you can't slow down the traffic. The cars would still go 30 miles an hour, even if you had a lot of traffic around. The only way you do that is really close down the street and manage and so forth. And traffic engineering was able to help us work with the bicycle group and so forth to kind of document that by putting up cameras and so forth, and actually videotaping a lot of our move-ins. We've seen some close calls, things that really made people understand that this is more of a dangerous situation than you think. Mm-hmm. It really took the pictures to kind of show that before.
Right, right.
Just talking to people about it didn't help. So a lot of those things, sometimes you're working on things years in advance to make it better for the future. So that's, I guess, what we mean by a three-day move-in.
Right.
And I was that point person. You know, since that time, I certainly pour a number of more people in that are more involved with that. But I, for a number of years, that was a huge piece of one of my duties.
And then what's the difference between, from your perspective, of course, between move in and then move out?
So move out is spread out more. And people know their way around. Mm. People know where they're going. They know where to park. They've figured it out over the academic year. Mm-hmm. We provide them a space at move out time just for them to load up and move out, but they don't hang around either. Mm. So they'll come, they'll load out, and they're out of here. And they know they're typically not looking for after unloading parking or anything like that. So if we can provide a space for them to load up and get out of here, mm-hmm. they're gone. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, they're spread out from the time. So you have quite a few more days. People sometimes move belongings out even the weekends before and start taking things home to make that last stage simply a pickup.
Right.
Move in. People come. It's a very emotional time, family time, so people want to stick around. So they're looking for extra time, and takes them longer to get their room set up. It's pretty common for them to go out for lunch or dinner then, right? Mm-hmm. So not only are we trying to provide them that space for in the time to get them moved in, but really an opportunity to say goodbye and enjoy the excitement too.
Right. So. So at least one other thing that are on these bullet points, and that's the, there's actually two, but I'll start with this one. The co-design, the co-manage, the two residence halls built to the acronym LEED, Silver Standards. So first off, so what were those halls? And then I might ask, depending on, you know, how that goes, we'll ask some follow-up questions about that.
So the,
you see what I'm looking trying
to,
at? There,
yeah, right? I do. I'm trying to think of which, got to think back, which there were several new halls. But this one's gold. I'm trying to think of which one was silver now. Mm.
Well, maybe as you're thinking about that, maybe the question more is, let's talk a little bit about what that is. Because, again, we don't know who will listen, whether it's gold or silver.
So LEED has to do with sustainable building design. So there's kind of a checklist that you would go through, and you get points. For instance, trying to think of a few. Environmental design, for instance. There's kind of a checklist and you can pay for someone to come in and kind of review this and actually get, there's a lot of times we'll build to LEED standards, but we won't actually get a LEED certification and so forth. And so LEED standards would be recycling. You know, you monitor and you will document all the recycling that's done on the construction project. And it will meet a certain level. At times, we will supply a certain number of bike racks or covered bike racks to encourage people using their bikes. There's guidelines for the HVAC systems and recirculating air and recouping energy from exhaust air and those types of things, lighting. So there's a whole laundry list of things, and you get points for a certain, and the number of points you get kind of leads you to a gold, silver, platinum kind of levels. And you can either build to those standards, which we do, and then you can take it a step further where you actually get certified, where you hire a team to actually come in, document, double check, make sure that everything's performing how it should, and you eventually then get a kind of a plaque on the wall that this building was built to LEED standards and actually certified as such. That kind of makes sense.
So sort of the follow-up to that is then, I mean, why is that, why does University Housing or you in facilities, the director of facilities, why is that important?
Well, the first thing I'd say, it's good for the environment, and it's actually short-term. And it's good for everyone long-term. Typically, buildings built to a higher standard like this will perform much better over time, less costly to perform over time. I mean, those are some of the big reasons up front that you'd want to. We're pretty quick to, you know, some other things like solar hot water, things we take on, are pretty, you'll see that in, matter of fact, all of our most recent halls. So I think they're just good all the way around for all, and it helps, and visually when people see that. Like if you go over and see Leopold, I think it's important for us to show that we are taking the right steps and being environmentally friendly and understanding that all of the residents that are staying here in our halls are really our future long term. So we want to leave something better than. And I think building these buildings environmentally friendly and sustainable the best we can is part of that. So
you just said the word Leopold. I wonder if you could talk again, because we don't know who would listen to this. Talk a little bit more about, because some people might hear Leopold and think Aldo Leopold, which is what it's named after. Yeah. But if you could talk a little bit about that building specifically, just again to give people a bit more context.
Yeah, so Leopold Hall was our last of our brand new buildings. It is one of our buildings that we had certified, actually, as far as LEED standards go, and I'd have to double check on whether it's silver or gold right now. It is a building we've done some special things in, of course. We do have a solar hot water loop. We've also set up some metering. We've wired the areas in certain ways so you can eventually have competitions and those types of things, so you can meter things differently. It's home to, well, it's, and I'm not sure how many are, it actually has a greenhouse on the top floor. That our greenhouse learning community uses. and which is, I think, very, very unusual. And I think our dining unit has even used it at times to grow some produce and so forth. It's a building of 170 some, so it's a fairly small building compared to some of our larger ones. But does that help?
Yep.
Thank you. The other question I want to ask today, and is the execution of the Residence Hall and Dining Services Master Plan. Yeah. So you mentioned earlier that you came here when a master plan was. So maybe first in general, time. let's talk a little bit initially about why is a master plan important, and then maybe we'll ask sort of specifics about this last one.
So, there's two big reasons why. One of them may surprise you a little bit, and I'm not sure. And that is, our construction projects can be political, and sometimes you do a master plan and you document it so you can sell projects. All our projects need to be approved by a number of individuals, not knowing much about us. And so you do that so you can show your what you're all about, why you're doing it, what are your priorities, and in hopes to sell all those individual projects. So that's one thing. The other way is to really be strategic in how you go about things and put serious thought into how you're going about renovating the buildings step by step. Costs associated, impacts on your performance, and individuals. We have to spend a lot of time kind of laying out how we go about projects, because we can only take down, well, right now we can't take down any spaces during the academic year. And during the summer, we're limited as to how many we can take down because of our conference operation. We do have one of the biggest conference operations in the country. And so we limit that. And so we have to kind of strategically lay out building after building how we're going to go about it, which buildings. And that really ties into the approval process. So if you don't get approvals for us, which is different than others on this campus, if we don't get approvals on a particular project, it not only impacts that project, but it impacts every other one, because it starts shoving them all out to future years. So those are kind of the main, I would say, the biggest kind of reasons.
So then maybe using this most recent master plan as a for example, can you talk a little bit about the process involved in creating one? Because I'm guessing it's not easy.
No, it's definitely, and there's a lot of, I would say, when we did this last one, there's a lot of thought even prior to putting pen to paper on anything as far as that actual document goes. We spent a lot of time up front looking at different buildings regarding whether we should demolish, whether we should renovate, what types of rooms you should build in the future, student input. We spent time with residents, kind of giving them, I remember there was one game we kind of played, where you gave people kind of tickets, and on there was amenities and dollar values associated to try and figure out. So we would tell, it's so much to air condition a building, but you only have $10 to work with, and you give them all these amenities worth a certain, and you find out what's important to our residents. So we spent a lot of time trying to figure out on the front end what should we do long term, what buildings can we work with the actual bones or structure, or are there ones we need to tear down, and kind of what are those costs? If our residents want more room space, I know, because I spent a lot of time trying to figure out what that means in some of our buildings, and I know that expanding room space would have caused us to raise rates considerably over the years in our renovation. That's one of the reasons why we chose to concentrate more on common areas in our residence hall renovations, meaning expanding common areas versus resident room space. So you still go to a lot of our spaces. The room sizes are still the same. We'll fix them up. We'll air condition them. But we've added common area space where we can. We've upgraded bathrooms where we can, those kinds of things. We've stuck with, you know, one of the things that came out of working with students was, you know, most areas don't have kind of traditional, most campuses don't have more traditional kind of residence halls. You know, you'll find a lot of them building apartments, even within the state. We're kind of unusual. We've chose to really build kind of a pod arrangement so people have to leave their room to use bathroom facilities. And that really came from a lot from our residents saying, you know, that's where we meet people. You know, if you get, you know, get us out of our resident rooms, you know, and community. So we've chose to go that direction thus far. And that's so what I'm saying is we spent, gosh, a long time before, including market studies. If I remember correctly, we even hired Bradford and Dunley. There was a firm that we hired to come in and actually study the market to see what our capacity might be or what it should be. That's where we determined kind of how many more spaces we needed, and based on some assumptions of our ability to provide housing to all freshmen that wanted to live with us. So all kinds of these things were done up front. In addition to working with FBNM, I mean, we didn't do this. You know, we did a lot of work within housing, but we clearly worked with our campus partners, primarily FBNM at that time as well. And Alan Fish, who was a big supporter when he was... So, kind of forgot where I was going with all this.
This was the, I think it was the thought about, the thought going into creating, or the process actually of creating the actual, the plan.
Yeah, I mean, so I guess to kind of sum it all up, there were definitely a group of us sitting down and talking through this. I specifically spent a lot of time, clearly with Paul, my boss at the time, with residents. We have an advisory board that we use a lot at that time. And as for the specific process, I guess, you know, it's gathering information. It's trying to make those determinations on the basics of what are your priorities. So if you look in our master plan, you're going to see a list of kind of priorities in there for us. Where we go on a dining was part of that master plan. So, of course, we spent a considerable amount of time trying to determine what direction we would go with dining. There was different types of ways to go. We ended up with a marketplace kind of style that you wind up. So,
So let me ask one follow-up, and then we'll wrap up for today. I say today because... I'm reserving the right to do a follow-up here. Because there's some things that I just don't think we'll have time to get to.
Okay.
So I want to follow up to this just to make sure we kind of... the libraries, of which I'm a part, the archives is part of the libraries, we just did a facilities master plan.
Okay.
And got a little bit of pushback once it was presented. And so I'm wondering in general... and it could be, maybe it wasn't with this master plan, but you've been a part of some.
Okay.
Has there been pushback? And if so, where were the points that people were pushing back against once they saw the plan?
So we had no pushback whatsoever on campus. And matter of fact, campus has, I think, has always been quite supportive. Our pushback and the primary pushback came from private landlords, primarily one, and And the idea was that the private sector can fulfill the needs of any students that want to come to the UW campus. And so that was really the pushback. It just so happens where that kind of shows up more is really downtown at State Building Commission and so forth. Of course, they do hire lobbyists just like anybody else. And, you know, all projects need to be approved through the State Building Commission. So that's where it gets political. So that's really where our pushback came. It's still out there today, you know, some of that. Not probably as intense as before. It was a bit intense because we were clearly looking to add bed spaces at that time. And we listed how many in our plan and why. So it was out there. And so that was the pushback. I do think, I mean, just kind of my personal opinion, just to throw it in, I think it doesn't really look at some of the facts. I mean, if you really want to look at the facts and why it's important to stay in the residence halls for your, at least your first year, if not 2 years. I mean, if you start looking at graduation rates, there's quite a difference. retention rates, there's quite a difference for those who at least stay in a residence hall for their first year. If you look at the data from our campus, it's striking, actually. I'm actually surprised, and I know these because recently I spent a little bit of time with some of our legislators in talking to them about encouraging them to approve our salary project coming up or included in the biennial budget. And it's one of the things that I would bring up.
All right, one more thing.
Yeah.
So I think I might know the answer to this. I'm going to ask you, though. So why do you think there wasn't any pushback on campus?
I guess I will never know for sure, but what I like to think is that those on campus do understand the importance of living in a residence hall for at least their first year, if not two. They look at the numbers just like I see the numbers, and they see there is a difference. And it's not just a percentage point. I mean, it's in the tens difference.
Mike, so we've been talking for almost an hour, and as I said, I want to do a follow-up interview. But if there's anything on your mind that my questions have brought up that you feel like if you don't say it, you may not remember it in the follow-up session, I want to give you space basically for any sort of final thoughts before we wrap up today.
Is it bad for me to say I don't have any final thoughts?
No, it means I did a great job.
Okay, you did a great job. You got me talking, which is kind of, and it was actually fairly easy for me to talk. Hopefully it came off coherent. I tend to think that I try and listen more than I do talk, but I think that's what most would say about me.
Well, Mike, I want to thank you for your time today. Yeah. So this concludes the first oral history session with Mike Kinderman.
Thank you.
Okay, today is August 12th, 2019. This is a follow-up interview with Mike Kinderman. We are back at his offices. Which hall are we in?
We are in Turner House.
Turner House, okay.
Crunsage Hall.
Which is near the boathouse, for those who may not know exactly where this is. And my name is Troy Reeves. So, Mike, as we did in the previous interview, if you could start by saying your name and spelling your last name.
My name is Mike Kinderman, K-I-N-D-E-R-M-A-N.
Great. Make sure everyone's good. Get that a little closer to you. So we didn't get to a few of the questions that I had hoped to get to in our first interview, which is why we're doing this follow-up interview. Some of these questions are questions I ask everyone who receives an academic staff award, and then there's some questions specifically about your work. So let's start with the academic staff questions, although this one pertains one way or the other, which is how have changes in technology changed your work?
Geez, this is probably, when I said I read through the questions, this is probably the one I thought about out of all of them probably the most, because it's interesting, when I first started here, I remember those green kind of computer screens that ring a bell.
Mm-hmm.
We used to actually call people by phone all the time and actually go to people's offices.
Mm-hmm. All right, so you were saying the phone rang as you were saying that we used to call people and actually go to their offices.
Yeah, now it's people laugh about it, but we'll be few offices apart, someone will send me an email, so just how we communicate and interact with one another has changed dramatically. Also, everything's documented now, of course, in emails and so forth. So it's everything's documented. So the communications—it's in some respects, it's helpful, I think, because everyone's memories here, there, and you can always go back, refresh your memory about those conversations that you may have had via email. But I do think it does tend to hurt from kind of a social aspect at times, and actually getting to know people. That's what I would say kind of from me personally. I think social media has had an impact, particularly on kind of the facilities world, I think. For instance, if you have any kind of even incident or perceived incident in a hall, it's out there to thousands of people immediately, or can be. Sometimes it's true, sometimes it's not. And not only are you trying to solve whatever issue or whatever problems out there, but you're also worried about the communication, the social media piece that's out there that may be driving something that's not true, or even how you're going about something. So it's not just trying to fix the problem anymore. It's trying to communicate with thousands of people when things get out there so quickly now. You can't keep up. It's very tough to keep up with that. So that piece comes to mind as far as technology goes. Data, there's so much data out there in the facilities world regarding equipment, and it's just easier now to absorb. It's easier to manipulate, so you can look for certain pieces to help predict problems. Overall, I think it's actually the technology is actually a good thing. But the one piece that I don't know that I struggle with it, but I would say the social interaction piece. People can hide behind the computer sometimes and avoid the face-to-face and discussion where... that even happens with the interactions with our customers at times. Someone might be unhappy with something, and it's pretty easy for them to be brutal over an email, but then you call them up and talk to them over the phone, and usually people are polite and professional and so forth. People tend to be less professional sometimes over email. At least that's been my experience. So those are the pieces that come to mind.
Thank you. When you were nominated, each winner has a little blurb on the web, and your nominators, or at least in that web blurb, I believe, they talked about you and your role in improving workplace culture. So how do you feel that you helped to improve workplace culture in housing?
I guess I've always had this feeling of, you really need to help your staff succeed. That's kind of always been kind of buried with me. It's not about me. It's really about our whole team succeeding and my team succeeding. You know, so with that being kind of buried in me, it's something that I've always kind of pushed on people. It's something that I talk about a lot. I mean, any new staff person that comes to work for us, when I meet with them, it's a topic. A topic that it's not my job. My job is to help you. I mean, that's my job here. That has, you know, along with I'm always willing to listen. Always willing to help staff. I do think to do a good job around here, you need to care about what you do and who you work with. Maybe not be the best friends, you know, but I do think you need to care about the people and what we do here if you're going to be successful and even want to be here. And I just, I guess I've tried to portray that and really find people that kind of had that mentality as well. I've been lucky. I mean, it's not just me. I mean, our culture change, and I do think there has been a culture change, has been a collective of a lot of people. I might have had probably the most to do with maybe hiring a lot of those people, but it's really them wanting to help everyone succeed, understanding, you know, we all have things we bring to the table to help us become better. Another thing I tell people, you know, I've been here quite a long time. I get blinders on it. You know, I don't see, you know, many times we've done it for 20 years or whatever, and that might not be the right way to do it anymore. And I just simply don't see that. I need, you know, I encourage staff to speak up. I'm always looking for feedback. I think those things over time have, you know, trying to pull people into the operation of residence hall facilities as a whole and really make sure everyone knows they're a piece of our bigger puzzle. Mm-hmm. Everyone has something to bring to the table. That's probably what I think has helped improve culture, along with a lot of good people with that mindset.
Okay. A follow-up to that, I think you mentioned this in the first interview, the importance of listening. So I'm wondering how you think you have become a good listener.
Wow. Well, I don't know that I'm great at it. I think people seem to be comfortable opening up to me, which is probably a good sign, right? Not a great answer to your question, but
it's just one of those things that. You know, in my job, I hope I'm a good listener. I don't think I'm a great listener. So I'm always interested when people have either been explained as a good listener. I'm always curious to if they've ever sort of thought about how they become.
So I've been told that you're a good listener. I honestly can't say that I know I am. It's just I do care about what people have to say. Usually they're coming to me with either improvement items, areas of concern, suggestions, feedback. And I think the only way you're going to get better in any kind of operation, you need to listen to those things. So I don't know, maybe it's because I truly think that's important. And it maybe comes across that way to them.
Mm-hmm.
Because I do. I think it is important. But I don't know that I could point to any one, two things that I think I do that make them feel that way.
All
Does
right.
that make sense?
Yes.
Sorry.
Mm-hmm. So the next question on the list is, again, back to an academic staff question, and that's were you or have you been involved in academic staff governance or groups?
So I have not, actually.
Okay.
it's just not something that I've, I don't know, I guess I haven't explored or looked into. I don't know if it's a time thing, but you probably shouldn't fall back. It's more of a probably a priority thing, mm-hmm. you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay. This question, again, I ask of every Academic Staff Award winner, and it may not pertain directly to you because of, you know, where you are and who you work, but I do want to ask it, and that's, do you think about the relationship between faculty and staff, and if so, what are your thoughts?
I honestly, it isn't something that I spend a lot of time thinking about. I probably have had very limited kind of relationships with faculty on campus. We tend to use the, you know, we certainly reach out to different faculty. You know, the good thing about being in Wisconsin is that there's experts on everything, right? So when you have a water quality issue in a building, mm-hmm. there's people. If you have a pest control issue, you know, I remember speaking to, I think it was Phil Pelletieri, I think it might, mm-hmm. I think that's his name, mm-hmm. but it just knows everything about, mm-hmm. You know, their area of expertise. So that's probably where I've had my most experience with faculty, reaching out to them on things we simply can't figure out. We're more kind of generalists in a way, and that expertise has helped us.
Right.
So,
then besides faculty in your position, who, and it doesn't have to be on campus, like who are the primary people that you work with / reach out to?
So it's probably different areas on campus. When it comes to major projects, of course, we have a close relationship with those at facilities planning and management. Kip and Dave Darling and that group. Certainly people at UW System, Alex Rowe in their facilities area and so forth, and then people downtown in DFDM. We definitely have a very close relationship with them and have for years and years and years. When it comes to other areas, like our housekeeping area, you know, or mechanical maintenance, we share and actually talk with our like areas on campus, mm-hmm. whether it be physical plant, whether it be the union, athletics. So those are kind of the areas that rec sports is probably another one. Mm-hmm. You know, we all kind of look to share information and learn from one another. I don't think that's
mm-hmm.
probably different. Is that what you were looking for?
Yep.
Okay.
Thank you. So one last question about the Academic Staff Award, and it's a multi-parter. So the first part was, you know, did you know you were being nominated?
Okay. I did find out after they were turned in. So, yes, I did prior to finding out whether I received the award or not.
Right. So what were your thoughts and reactions then when you found out that you received an award?
It was pretty when I received the award?
Well, when you heard that you...
When I heard about it, so I had... And this is, I think, almost as big as the award itself, okay? So when I... It was quite emotional. I mean, so when I found out about it is when I was showing the letters that mm-hmm. people had written. And, you know, you never... you don't think about yourself. And, you know, you read those letters and it's... even gets me emotional now, you know, because mm-hmm. I mean, some of the things that you see in there, you're like, wow, I mean, is that really what people think? I mean, it's it was pretty amazing. So that piece right there, just being nominated and reading through what people had to say was kind of an amazing. So whether I won or not, I don't know that would have mm-hmm. been made me feel any more or less than what I felt when I read the letters to begin with. And who, you know, and the people that they came from. It was pretty amazing.
Do you have any thoughts or memories about the reception?
Well, it was wonderful. I mean, it was a very nice event. You know, my family came, which was great. Even my in-laws came from Arizona, actually, flew here from Arizona, which was super nice. And all the people that, of course, had letters that I'd written, and some others as well, showed up to support me. It was wonderful. I mean, I think I showed up later than everyone else got there. I don't know, it was because of maybe I'm not big on those kind of events, you know. And you know, it's kind of about me. I like the letters. Just reading the letters made my day. I mean, that made more of my day. It made my year or career.
So I'm going to skip this sixth question and ask it last. Because it sort of makes sense.
The legacy.
Yeah,
oh.
That makes sense to ask last. So again, now there's some questions that were sort of follow-ups on the previous interview, plus just things that I think are interesting about your time here and your work here. So I noticed you said earlier you have a book out to talk a little bit about Deja Opal. So I'd ask your memories about the sort of the planning for and building up Deja Opal.
So I guess I've never thought of there's been a lot of buildings that we did. I mean, it's been a huge boom. There's very few people, you know, in housing worlds that probably experienced kind of that I was fortunate enough to be part of. Starting with Smith Hall and Aug Hall and of course, Dejope, Leopold, and all the other renovations that we've kind of taken on. So, I mean, I don't necessarily... Deja Opal is one of a number that I think were really kind of cool. I think a lot about the planning that all the time spent kind of up front trying to lay out what to do with some of our halls, whether we should tear them down or whether we should renovate them, or when we build new, how do you figure out what style to build? Spending time with our residents to try and figure that out. So there was a lot of time up front trying to figure those pieces out. Those are probably what I remember most. And then just the approval process and how it's not always easy in our state, and sometimes it's political. And then came the building, the buildings, which Dejope, I had to look back. We started construction, it looks like, in 2011, which it was several years before that when we were seeking approval. I couldn't even tell you right now when that was. So, gosh, we're going on, 10 years, right? Dejope was an interesting, it's one of the things, and this isn't an area that I spent a lot of my time on, but our director at the time, Dejope Paul, and kind of honoring the Ho-Chunk Nation and so forth, was, I think, the first of really its kind on our campus anyway, which I think is phenomenal, and some of the things we did in there that are special because of that. We have other renovations, though, that I think are wonderful as well. There's a really kind of our old historic buildings like Carson Gully, that if I had to look to one renovation, that's probably the one, because of I think it's just beautiful, the building outside and inside. If I'm looking at something that I think that is that I think most of our Big Ten counterparts would think, or maybe even a little crazy, is probably Whitty Hall, that renovation, doing it while occupied with 1,100 residents there. We're really the only ones in the Big Ten to take on something like that. And, we have a dedication this Sunday, for the new houses. So I think there's been a lot of different things I'd point to kind of over the year. DeJope is, I mean, it sticks out for some reasons, but there's a lot of things when I think about our construction and our master plan. And even prior to that, like I said, trying to get it in place.
I don't remember if I put this on the list, but maybe we can talk about this a little bit since you just mentioned it, and that's master plans. So things don't happen, at least, I'm guessing, at least in the recent past, without some sort of plan. So have you been involved in master planning? And if so, sort of what are your thoughts about that?
To our first master plan, which was more of a kind of a mechanical maintenance master plan, that's really what I was hired to manage, you know, when I first came down, you know, as a construction rep. But then became very much involved with the planning of the next master plan, which was really 2004 to 2020 was how it was laid out anyway, although we'll go beyond 2020 with this. We've had a few snags here and there with approvals, and that's usually where snags have come in, trying to get people to approve the projects downtown. But that's really the front, you know, what I was talking about before, you know, spending the time on what to do with some of our older buildings, whether to renovate, tear down, start over, and then where to build on this campus. We spent a considerable amount of time with those on campus trying to figure that out. Space is limited. So I was heavily involved with this last master plan, the one we continue to work on now. That's where most of my memories are, really, with the construction piece. Even though I'm still involved with design and so forth, once projects start now, I have some very good people that spend most of their time on site, and I'm not there day to day during the construction and so forth anymore.
So when you say you were heavily involved in the current, the master plan that's sort of winding down, how would you answer or give examples to how you were involved in it?
I would have been part of a very small group that would spend a considerable amount of time with residents trying to figure out, we have an advisory board. I remember sitting down with them and talking through, we actually gave them, assignments, like, come back with your perfect dorm room, you know, lay it out, or give them, we gave them money, fake money, to spend on certain amenities in a building, like so much for air conditioning, so much for whatever, this amount of common space. And it was a way to try and figure out what's most important for residents. So we spent a considerable amount of time with residents. We went to other schools to see what they were building, what were the trends out there. Spent a bit of time trying to figure out what was most cost effective. Taking some of our high-rise buildings, you know, is it more important? Do residents really want more room space or more common space? And what was the most cost-effective way to go? We eventually found out that, and I think rightly so, that expanding resident room space is a very costly venture, and probably not the most important. And you really see that throughout our master plan, where we fix up resident rooms. We don't add space there, but we try to add common room spaces, classrooms, technology rooms, those types of things. If we would have started adding, I think we figured out the cost of those additional spaces that you would have to add would just turn out to be phenomenal, and it would end up raising rates across the board. And that was a piece. What buildings could you actually renovate and still be what you wanted? You know, are the bones good? We did have one building we took down, Aug Hall, a big 10, 11-story building, two towers. I'm not sure if you remember Aug being around the whole time. You know, and that had a structure that we didn't feel we could really work with, cost-wise, for mechanicals and the new things we'd have to put in the building to make it work for another 50 years. Mm-hmm. We did find out, though, that Celery and Woody would be able to do that if we could live with the floor-to-ceiling heights, and we mm-hmm. made that decision that we could. And that's why we're renovating those versus the others. So we spent, those are some examples, I guess, of pieces that I would have spent time on.
Okay.
Is that helpful?
Yes, okay. Thank you. All right, so we kind of just hit the other buildings and renovation projects that stand out in your mind, unless there are some. You mentioned Carson, Witte. Of course, I asked about DeJo. Are there others that stand out in your mind?
You know, Leopold does. The interesting piece about Leopold, and I got to give credit to our previous director on this. We have a greenhouse up top. I mean, it's just an interesting feature, mm-hmm. I guess. But Carson, to me, stands out just because I think it's such a beautiful building. Witte stands out, like I said, just because it's kind of unheard of what we did there.
Mm-hmm.
I hope we can replicate that with Celery.
So, could you talk a little bit more about the greenhouse? One of my specific questions is, like, sort of who has access to it and what is it? Why is it even there?
So, this is an area that I probably don't have a lot of expertise in, but so we do have a greenhouse learning community. So we do have faculty involvement and classes revolving around kind of sustainability and so forth. And this was one of the reasons why there. The building's also named after Aldo Leopold. And that all kind of tied together. I don't know that I have a lot of...
Okay. So does that mean, though, that it's mainly students and faculty that have access to the greenhouse?
All the people in that building would have access. And actually, I had thought that we have used it at times, some of our dining, actually, to grow certain herbs and different things. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that that's done anymore. I think it is just the group, a lot of the learning community. But I do believe the whole building would have access to that space.
Okay. So I asked, this next question I asked you, I think, after the recording was over, and I just want to make sure we sort of get it on the record, because I guess I was always under the assumption that, well, first off, we have a short course, which, the short course is where students who aren't enrolled in the university get a chance to come here a couple of times a year, I believe, and learn about agriculture, farming, dairying, et cetera. And while they're here, they live here. So it's a long way of saying that I assumed that those halls were controlled by housing, but you told me that was not the case.
That is actually not the case. We have really very limited support of that area. They really run that themselves. We do help them out at times. Every now and then, and we work back and forth with them. It's just like any other campus entity, we have been asked, could you help? They might have been short-staffed at times. Could you help with this? Or something happens at night, could you help with that? We're always willing to help, but they actually run, they have their cleaning staff and so forth, so they kind of run their own kind mm-hmm. of operation. What's happened recently, though, just this year, Humphrey Hall will become a residence hall. They have condensed down into one building, Jorns. so we will be operating Humphrey as part of our Crossage units coming up for this next fall, which is very helpful right now because of the increased enrollment, and we're kind of running out of space. We have, so those spaces over there were definitely needed.
So besides finding or sort of falling into the fact that Humphrey Hall has now become a residence hall. How does one, or can one, find additional space to house students?
Well, we have turned over every rock, I will tell you. We started a year ago with tripling. As a matter of fact, it's been more than a year. So we've started looking at our larger doubles and look for spaces where we could realistically triple rooms. We've expanded that this year to probably as many as we could go or feel comfortable with. We started with that. We've also converted certain common area space over into resident rooms for permanent all-year use. Matter of fact, DeJope has some study spaces at the end of the hall, on here at each end, that we've actually converted into spaces for four individuals on each floor. So that's really the second phase. And then third, we've kind of increased the number of temp spaces in areas that we've never really used before. We've looked at dens that, and the hope would be that we would move those individuals that we, in what we call temp space, out into a regular assignment partway through the year. So we have maximized wherever we feel we could. We've, of course, added another floor that's opening up this year in Witte, so another 70-some spaces. We had hoped that in the future we will have a couple floors at Salary, additional floors, and we hope to build more space, really, and that's what we're looking at now.
I think for a short period of time, I don't remember exactly how long, you were interim housing director.
So you said you were going to ask me this, and I didn't even think about it.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, you know, how that came about, and then what you sort of did while you were there, anything that stands out in your mind.
Gosh, not a whole lot. I don't know. It wasn't a long period of time. It was only it was a few months. And, you know, my job, Daryl Bazell was our vice chancellor at the time. I do know our previous director had suggested that he make me interim director. And part of the reason I think he thought I could do a good job, just keeping the boat going straightforward, you know. You know, interim is not, you're not looking for someone to really, you know, take sharp curves here and there, right? You just want to continue doing the good job you're doing. And I think he felt, had confidence that I could do that. And I also wasn't applying for the director's position, which is another probably good thing, you know, that you're in competition, you're interim, and so forth. So those are probably a couple things. So, you know, as far as there probably aren't any huge highlights, it was kind of steady as she goes, you know. That really what I felt my job was. In addition to probably helping out the new director, whoever that was going to be at the time, was really my job shortly thereafter.
At this point, do you report directly to the director of University Housing? Is that your...
Correct. Okay. Correct, yes.
So you said you didn't apply.
Did not apply.
You did not apply. Why have you... I mean, if that's the only sort of place up for you, why have you chose... Or why did you choose not to apply?
There's probably a number of reasons. I mean, I guess first of all, you got to be. First of all, you got to want it, right? Or people see through that. I can't say that I just wanted that. it was something, you know, my background is all in facilities. I felt that there, the director of housing is, you know, we had 8 functional areas that reported through the director, that reports through the director of housing. So it's, you know, our operation is fairly good size. And there's areas that just, that aren't in my wheelhouse, that I probably wasn't as comfortable with, and didn't know how well I could do. I think the main thing is, though, you really just want it. I think there's people that want to be the director of housing, and you see those across the nation. That, you know, and those are typically, you know, Jeff Novick is one of those, you know, since he started his career in a housing operation, that was his goal. You know, he wanted to be the director of a housing operation. I can't say I've ever had that. I want to do a good job. I mean, I want to, that's probably more important to me. I mean, I want to do a good job for the division and for the people that I work with every day. I mean, and I think the further you go up, the less you have time with some of our staff. I even find it now. I mean, that's a piece that I don't, you know, you run out of time for all of your staff.
Okay.
And that would have been 400 or 500 staff at the time. I don't know that.
So I think we're back to the sort of the middle question on the list, but actually is, best as a final question, and that's legacy. And you'll see it's kind of a two-parter.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what do you feel you'll be remembered for, and is that what you would like to be remembered for?
I thought a little bit about this one because I'm not sure. You know, what I think when people, you know, what seems to come up, I'm related a lot to projects, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the master plan, and kind of, because people can visually kind of see those. And I've been involved with almost all, well, all the new ones, you know, that are up there, and most of the bigger, if not all, the bigger renovations that have been around. So as far as what people remember me for, I'm afraid that that's probably what they think about me. And I think that's one piece, I think. So that's what I think, and if I had to guess, you know, because that's what people see. And most people know, you know, I was in, you know, more of my construction background and being around all the design and those things and trying to shepherd certain projects through. What do I want to be remembered for? I do think it's partly what I think about is really kind of what I saw in those letters, you know, for that's probably what touched me. So those are the kind of things that I would much rather be known for, you know, being a care about your staff, you know, always around to support your staff and your team. And I think a lot of what, you know, looking for, I think, another piece that, you know, I want people that are committed, I mean, to, and how do you get people committed? You know, you get, you engage them, and you get them involved with what's happening, versus just telling people what to do, or, and they just, you know, they're robots, which doesn't help us. So I hope those are the kind of things that people think about. But I'm thinking it might be the construction thing.
Mike, is there anything else on your mind that you'd like to talk about, given this oral history?
Gosh, I'd love to tell you stuff, but I don't.
Okay.
You've pried a lot of stuff out of me that I, and I probably even talk more than I probably should about some things.
Well, I appreciate the times you've given me. So this concludes the Oral History with Mike Kinderman.